This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting for financial security for our seniors. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Christine Ross for Libby Znaimer. A Canadian filmmaker, the first person to cross the Trans-Canada Trail, shares her journey in a new documentary. And preparing your lawn after the damage from winter with tips from an expert. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. A relatively new common sweetener used in drinks, foods, and chewing gum can cause serious gut damage. A study out of the UK found the negative effect of Neotame can potentially lead to irritable bowel or other inflammatory diseases or insulin resistance. The newer sweeteners are 1,000 times sweeter than sugar. The effects of artificial sweeteners like saccharin, sucralose, and aspartame have been scrutinized in recent years, with the World Health Organization recommending people avoid using them for weight control.
The level of violation that we have monitored is unprecedented.
Agnes Callamard, Amnesty International Secretary General, with a warning this week of unprecedented human rights violations around the world. In its annual report on human rights in 155 countries, the agency found that governments, including the United States, Russia, and China, have led to a global disregard for international rules. It goes on to say that civilians in conflicts are paying the highest price, and the current lack of international rule of law is creating more discrimination, racism, and division. The Canadian military plans to destroy 11,000 Second World War-era pistols. The move comes as the government has now received all of the new replacement 9mm pistols as part of an almost $20 million project. Some of the older version, the Browning high-power handguns that were used for decades, will be kept for museums, some may be used for special training, and the rest will be destroyed by year's end. Millions of older adults, both Spanish and foreigners, living in Spain, are eligible for heavily subsidized vacations. Since its launch 3 years ago by the Spanish government to offer affordable holidays to seniors, it's been steadily growing in popularity post-pandemic. The idea is to help older adults improve their quality of life, which then takes the burden off social care budgets. The scheme also benefits the economy and the tourism industry, as the majority of those subsidized trips must be taken in the low season, meaning more people will be employed in the sector for longer periods of time.
From the forest.
Some people get more pleasure from music than others, and a new study finds that it's all in your genes. Researchers in the Netherlands found that identical twins experience more similar levels of pleasure when listening to music than non-identical twins, suggesting a genetic element. All of the study's twins were raised in the same households with similar environmental exposures while growing up, making it easier to rule out genetic contributions. The research team also argues that learning instruments is heavily impacted by genes. It's been 63 years since the Dick Van Dyke Show made its television debut. Now, at age 98, the show's star has become the oldest daytime Emmy nominee in the awards history this year. Legendary actor and comedian Dick Van Dyke has been nominated for his guest spot on the soap Days of Our Lives, where he played an elderly man with amnesia. The venerable actor says that he's played old men before, but in a comedic role, and that this is the first time he ever just played himself. The awards will be handed out June 7th. I'm Christine Ross, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world.
The Trans-Canada Trail
connects three oceans. There are 24,000 kilometers of trails, and I'm going to try to travel from one end of the continent to the other.
That's from the documentary 500 Days in the Wild by award-winning filmmaker Diane Whelan, who spent 6 years crossing the entire 24,000-kilometer Trans-Canada Trail, mostly alone. She began in St. John's, Newfoundland in 2015, ending in Victoria, BC in 2021, and has documented her trek across the world's largest trail in her new film that's now streaming. We reached Diane at her home in BC. Why did you decide to take on such a monumental trip at age 50?
I have made a film on the highest mountain in the world, Mount Everest, and I've made a film on the most northern coastline in the world, the Canadian High Arctic. So in part, just from a professional perspective anyway, making a film on the longest trail in the world seemed like a natural next step, you know? But it also began, the project also began to take shape at a significant time in my life. Maybe that's why they call it the midlife crisis. It's a time when you want to check in and really make sure that your life is in alignment with yourself, like that you're living an authentic existence. And so I like to tell people it was time to check out, to check in. You know, my marriage had just ended. My dog of 16 years had died, those kinds of things, you know. The life I had was over. And I just really wanted to get away from the news, relationships, and money. And I needed a new film project.
How rugged is the trail, and how did you get around other than walking and hiking it?
Well, I did many things, actually. So the Trans-Canada Trail, for those that aren't really aware of it, officially opened in Canada in 2017. When I left on it, it was a 24,000-kilometer trail, and I wanted to do one that connects three oceans. It's actually made up of 487 different land and water trails. So the Trans-Canada Trail is both a land and a water trail. So I hiked. I mountain biked when I was on dirt roads or old rail lines. I canoed close to 8,000 kilometers, which included a paddle on Lake Superior, as well as a 4,000-kilometer paddle to the Arctic Ocean. And then I ended on the Pacific Ocean. So the last couple hundred kilometers were also a paddle into Victoria. And then in the winter months, I snowshoed or backcountry skied pulling a sled.
What challenged you the most physically and mentally, and did you ever have thoughts of giving up?
Well, physically, I mean, you know, I didn't go as an extreme athlete. I went as an artist. You know, I was like more inspired by the Emily Carrs and the Group of Seven. It was on the job training. So physically, of course, the beginning was a little bit hard on my body, but you know, I broke in and I got in better shape as I was out there and I adapted. Psychologically, there was a lot of fears I had to overcome right from day one, you know, just being a woman alone in the woods. I think a lot of other women can understand that, you know. There's no lock on a tent door. So, you know, I had to overcome a lot of fear right from the very beginning. But here's what I learned. You know, when you challenge a fear like that, night after night, night after night, a year goes by, nothing happens. So guess what? That fear starts to go away. You know, a lot of people always ask me, like, aren't you alone out there? You know, a couple months, you don't see anybody. Like, you know, and I'm like, you know, it's the oddest thing. And one of the things that comes up in the film, of course, is that, you know, humans are just 0.001% of all life on Earth. So when you're out there by yourself, after a while, you start to feel more connected to life than you ever have because you're connecting to that other 99.9%.
Conversely, you know, we've talked about the challenges. What was it that inspired you most about the trip? Would you say it is that connection?
I think the connection to self and the connection to others, and really, I just found so much hope. You know, it was also a journey of reconciliation for me. I'm a Canadian of settler descent. You know, my mom's ancestors were from France and arrived 400 years ago, and my father's ancestors were from Ireland, and they've been there a couple hundred years as well. So, you know, I'm of settler descent, and so I spent a lot of time in Indigenous communities just that I was invited into, and just spent a lot of time listening and learning. And I found a lot of hope in those communities, in the way of they perceive the world, you know, and the relationship to the natural environment.
Diane, you have said it's not the journey, it's the destination. So what advice now, having gone through what you have gone through, would you give to other boomers who are maybe stuck, feeling like they need to shake things up in their life, maybe not being as badass as you and spending 2,000 days hiking across the country, but what advice would you give them?
Well, know your limits. I mean, like, you know, one of the wonderful things about getting older is, like, it isn't about the fastest way anymore. It's about the most meaningful way. And we can bring a lot of sensibility to our culture around these kinds of experiences that have become so much about the extremism, which, you know, and they're not. They're about, these journeys can be about connection. So, for instance, the Trans-Canada Trail is currently a 28,000-kilometer trail, 487 different trails. Some of them are really accessible. There's thousands of kilometers of old rail lines, and the great thing about an old rail line is it's never got more than a 3% grade on it. Those are great to ride. You can ride bikes on those in the summer. You can ski on those in the winter. Know your limit. Set a goal, and then just go do it.
So what's next for your documentary?
Right now, we're just about ready to leave for California. We are going to try to do an independent, Oscar-qualifying theatrical in L.A. It's from May 17th to May 23rd. All the ticket links are up on the 500 Days in the Wild website. But also, we're looking for some sponsors. If you're a little company out there and you want to see your name on the big screen and be a part of helping a Canadian film get into the Oscars for 2025, we are also looking for people like you. It's really inexpensive and you can help us out. So that information can be found at 500daysinthewild@gmail.com.
Diane Whelan, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
That was award-winning filmmaker Diane Whelan, whose new film, 500 Days in the Wild, is now streaming. I'm Christine Ross, and this is the Zoomer Weekend Review. Coming up, your lawn looking a little bleak after winter? Everything you need to get your lawn ready for spring and summer with an expert.
You're listening to the Zoomer Weekend Review, brought to you by CARP, bringing you vital information to boost your health, your finances, and your rights. Find out more at carp.ca.
So you're itching to get your lawn green and lush again after the damage of winter that can cause long-lasting damage. We live in a lawn-obsessed culture. Some say embrace the dandelions, others mortified by the sight of the annoying weeds on their lawn. What are the best practices you can do right now to get your lawn in the best shape? We consulted the expert, Professor Katarina Jordan, the director of the Guelph Turfgrass Institute. What is the number one thing people can do right now to get the best lawn possible after the damage from winter?
I would say that your first step is to rake any material that is covering your lawn. So any leaves that weren't picked up last year, any debris that might be out there, try to get as much light access to that turf that's trying to recover as possible. So I would say your number one thing right now is raking. There's generally enough, there are enough nutrients in the soil that you don't need to fertilize right away. You generally aren't, I don't think anything's growing quickly enough. If it is, then mowing is probably number two.
And what about seeding?
Overseeding is also a really great idea. It really depends on whether or not you currently have any thinned areas or bare areas. So any thinned lawn or bare lawn is going to be an excellent area for weeds to come in. If you do have bare areas, overseeding with a really high quality lawn mix, and that's really important too. What species to choose, it really depends on the environment. Do you have a lot of shade? Do you have a lot of sun? It's really hard to give specific recommendations, but that's why we recommend a three-way lawn mix, which has three species, some of which require more sun and some of which are more shade tolerant.
So rake, overseed, and you said you could mow the lawn. Now, I have a question for you. I've heard different opinions on this. How high should the blade be on the lawnmower in these early first cuts of the season?
Usually what we recommend is that your final lawn height should be about 7.5 centimeters or 3 inches. That's usually the recommendation. So it all depends on how high it has gotten. It really depends on what you want to use your lawn for, which is why, you know, whenever we talk about any of these issues, everyone wants, you know, these black and white answers, but sadly, it's all shades of gray. So it all depends on what you're using your lawn for and what you want your ultimate height to be. There's a rule that in turf that we say it's called the one-third rule. It works for a lot of plants as well, but we certainly use it for turf. And what it suggests is that you should never take off more than one-third of that plant height at any one mowing.
What about aerating? Does that need to be done every year?
So it really depends on the quality of the soil and the status of the soil. The purpose of aeration primarily is to break up that soil. If you have an area that gets compacted really easily every year, then a spring aeration is recommended. The big thing is to make sure that it gets done when the soil is relatively dry. You don't want to have somebody come in and aerate right after a rainfall, because at that point your soil is more pliable, and so you're not actually breaking it apart, you're just kind of mushing it together.
We're almost into May, and there is this movement called No Mow May. What is it?
Well, as I understand it, it was actually initiated, I believe, in the UK, and the idea was to not mow your lawn for an entire month, to allow pollinator species to actually grow a little bit taller and flower and provide access for pollinators, in particular bees.
A good intention, would you recommend it? Is it a good approach?
If your goal is to have a thick, lush lawn comprised of turf grass, then we do not recommend No Mow May. Also, if that is your goal, then you probably already have primarily grass, in which case the what would be flowering within your lawn is likely not going to be the best thing for pollinators. On the other hand, if you want to have a more ecologically friendly, if you will, home lawn that is something where you're not necessarily playing on it or walking on it, but you want it to be a diverse ecosystem where pollinators can come and they can feed. In that case, then, maybe it's not the worst idea, but what is actually growing? What is actually flowering? I think No Mow May will work better if you ensure that you have the right species of plants within your lawn.
I've read somewhere there are 6.2 million lawns in Canada. Why are we Canadians and North Americans really so obsessed with having beautiful lawns?
To some, it is aesthetically pleasing. There are some who much prefer to have vibrant colors of blooming flowers, but for some, just having that that homogeneous or pure stand, if you will, of turf grass is really visually and aesthetically pleasing. There are others because of the functionality. One of the beauties of turf grasses versus other plants is that they can withstand a great deal of wear. We know that. We see that in the parks. We see it on professional sports fields. It can withstand a great deal of wear, and so it has a functionality or allows a functionality that other plants do not. I think a lot of people just think it looks beautiful, and as a result, I think it tends to increase property values too.
Dr. Katarina Jordan, thank you for this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
That was Katarina Jordan, a professor of plant agriculture at the University of Guelph and the director of the Guelph Turfgrass Institute. I'm Christine Ross, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Christine Ross for Libby Znaimer. Thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi, Christine Ross, and Paul Thomas, with technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Znaimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.